43, he meets up with with Hugh Douglas and John Cockburn, both of which are aristocrats. They are Scottish lairds, and they are both friendly to the Reformation, and they want a tutor for their sons. And so John Knox is hired as a tutor for their sons. Both of these men are supportive of the Reformation in Scotland. They have already been involved in it. They're fully committed to it. And it's about this time that Knox himself comes under the influence of the Reformation and Reformed thinking himself. So that brings us to the Scottish Reformation. As you've gathered from this, it's 1546, and the Reformation is already in Scotland, and John Knox is not the one who brought it there. So he's not a reformer in the sense of Luther or Zwingli, where he has to break ties with Rome. It's already going on. He's in it. He's getting to see it play out. But Scotland is at this point very much Catholic. James V had died, and his widow, Mary of Guise, became the Dowager Queen. Her daughter, Mary Queen of Scots, was 6 days old at the death of James V, and so they needed a regent to rule the kingdom. There was a very strong connection with France, Mary of Guise being from France herself. She was French, and so solidifying this alliance between France and Scotland. Scotland was seen by France as a potential launching pad for an attack on England. If they wanted a two-front war, they could land in Scotland and then come in from the north rather than invading from the south, because the English Channel becomes a bit treacherous for a landing on the southern shores of England. So by landing safely in Scotland first, they might be able to march an army south. So there was this constant political maneuvering in Scotland to be allied with France. A lot of the Scots did not like this, but the monarchy was very open to it because of Mary of Guise being French. One particular politician, political weasel, we might say, was a guy named David Beaton. David Beaton had worked his way up through the French court and through the Scottish court, had achieved multiple grants of land and titles, and ultimately was named cardinal in Scotland in the early 1500s. The Pope created his seat as a cardinal just for him because he was such a good political a lobbyist for all sides, and he was probably the most corrupt man in all of Scotland. He's a very evil man who has committed many crimes, stealing lots of land, but he does it all legally under the cover of the law. When the Reformation first comes to Scotland, George Wisehart and Patrick Hamilton are both preaching in Scotland. They're both preaching the Reformation in Scotland in 1528. It's important to note that Patrick Hamilton was born in 1500, so he's probably a little bit older than Knox at this point. But this is going on while Knox is still in his formative years. This is a very major event that David Beaton has Patrick Hamilton arrested and killed. And it is determined by popular opinion that this was because of a personal grievance, not because of a religious conviction. Hamilton's positions in preaching the gospel, he was simply reading scripture, and David Beaton was convicted of his own sins and believed that this was treason and sedition, and so he had Hamilton executed because of the personal attacks on himself. And it was seen as Beaton being an unrighteous man, as Beaton being an unrighteous man and killing a righteous man. And so this was the popular opinion, and it caused a firestorm throughout Scotland. Wisehart escaped the wrath of David Beaton on that particular occasion. But in 1544, he returned to Scotland. And at this point, as Wisehart returns to Scotland, Beaton hasn't forgotten him. David Beaton hasn't forgotten who Wisehart is. And as Wisehart starts preaching throughout Scotland, a warrant goes out for his arrest. Now, he happened to be staying at the house of a man named Hugh Douglas. Now, Hugh Douglas, we've already mentioned, is a friend of John Knox. John Knox has been hired as the tutor for his sons, and Wiseheart is staying in Hugh Douglas's house, as is John Knox. So they're both staying at the same on the same manor. They're both in the same area. They're both running in the same circles. And as the arrest warrant goes out for George Wiseheart, Knox decides that he's going to serve as Wiseheart's bodyguard. Now, this is actually quite comical because everybody describes Knox as a wee Scotsman, not imposing at any on any level. But at the same time that he's acting as a bodyguard, he's carrying around a huge two-handed broadsword. So he's this little shrimpy Scotsman with this great big broadsword walking around. He's going to be George Wiseheart's bodyguard. And so Wiseheart goes around preaching and is ultimately, as the arrest warrant comes down and they're going to, and the word comes that they're coming for Wiseheart, Wiseheart looks at the situation. He looks at this scrawny little twerp with this big sword, and he decides to confiscate the sword and tells Knox, go home. Tells him, one is enough for a sacrifice. Go home to your kids. Go to the kids and be a tutor. We don't need to both get arrested here. So when Wiseheart is arrested by Baton, he is immediately taken to St. Andrew's Castle and put through a very, very quick trial and immediately burned at the stake the next morning. And this was seen as not as a religious act on this by the Scottish people, but as straight up murder. And this created a bit of an outrage. But to his credit, David Baton had made a lot of enemies to this point. This wasn't the first outrage he had committed. And so Norman Leslie, who Baton had stolen a huge amount of land from and had completely disinherited, as well as William Kirkcaldy and John Leslie, spearheaded a movement to go and pay a visit to David Baton. And they showed up early in the morning. They killed the groundskeeper as soon as they walked in the gate and proceeded to execute Cardinal Baton in his own dining room. So, you know, you got this idea that they just broke into the castle. They execute the man. It's vigilante justice. But now they've pretty much made a stand that the reformers here, the reformed movement, has suddenly taken a stand against Baton for his execution of Wiseheart. It wasn't the only reason why they did it, but it was definitely the inciting incident. And so they realize they've got to fortify the castle, and they've got to hold their ground, or else they're going to get wiped out. So they start gathering everybody in. Everybody who had been supporting George Wiseheart starts coming to the castle. There is immediately arrest warrants put out for Hugh Douglas and John Cockburn. They start raising armies, going to fight and hold their position. And ultimately, they both tell Knox, go to the fort, take our kids with you, go to the fort. You'll be safer in the fort than out here running with us. And so they had been running for about 6 months to this point and told Knox, go to the fort and to St. Andrews. So at St. Andrews, the chaplain there is a man named John Rough. John Rough is preaching in the chapel, and he is preaching a Presbyterian polity, that is, that pastors ought to be elected by the common people and not designated by kings and popes. And as he's preaching this, John Knox has been there for a couple of weeks, and he has already heard of John Knox. He knows that John Knox has been ordained. He knows that he has a reputation as a scholar, as a theologian, and as a preacher. And so he actually nominates John Knox for lay preacher there at the fort. John Knox, in his own words, says that he immediately started weeping and fled the room. John Knox didn't ever intend to be a preacher. He wasn't wanting to be a leader of the Reformation. He was just a guy in a place when this was all going down. But ultimately, he was elected as the pastor and called as a lay pastor there in St. Andrews and served there as a preacher. In his first sermon, as we have seen with Luther and with Zwingli and with various others of the Reformed leaders in the past that we've covered. His first sermon is on Daniel 7 and how the Pope is the Antichrist. I mean, we're seeing a recurring theme here. His immediate break with Rome, his first sermon then on the on Daniel chapter 7. He serves as a pastor there for a couple of months, but in June, the French fleet shows up to besiege the city, besiege the fort, and it's taken by the French. There's a peace treaty signed, but all of the reformers go into prison, are imprisoned by the French. Many of them are shipped down to prisons on the continent, but John Knox remains remains chained to an oar in a French galley for 19 months. So what's interesting about John Knox is that when he writes his own stories, as he's writing his story, he never says anything in the first person. Everything is written in the third person. And so when he tells stories about himself, we only know it's a story about him when somebody else verifies that this was actually him that did this. Because he says, someone did this, and then somebody else has to say, no, Knox was the one who actually did that. So one such story which gets circulated is while he's on the boat, the French sailors decide they're going to convert these heretics, and they're going to get them to venerate the saints. And so they start passing around a picture of Mary and ordering them to kiss the picture of the Virgin Mary. And if the Protestant will not conform to this order, then they will be whipped. And so the statement is that as they came to Knox and they handed him the picture, he says, Our Lady seems light enough, I think she can swim. And he threw the picture into the water. And that was the end of that. They decided that this was not a good way to try to convert Protestants. Well, he remained a galley slave for 19 months, and by the end of it, he was extremely sick to the point of death. As they are on the ship, most of his comrades are afraid that he's about to die, and as they look out one moonlit night over the ocean, they see once again the silhouette of St. Andrews, their French ship. They're off the coast of Scotland, and he sees St. Andrews again, and he tells them, I'm not going to die until I preach there once more. And so he said, I'll preach there again before I die. And so they make it back to, they continue to say, at the end of 19 months, Edward VI has become king of England and has ransomed back all the prisoners that were taken at St. Andrews, including John Knox. So then Knox, no longer allowed to go to Scotland, finds safe passage to England. So from 1549 to 1554, he spends that time in England, as he is licensed to preach as an Anglican. He is required to use the Book of Common Prayer. He is required to use the 39 articles, or the 42 articles, as they were at this point, with Cranmer, and to operate according to the rules of the Church of England. Well, Knox didn't agree with all of Cranmer's half-reforms and wanted him to go further. And so he starts pushing the boundaries on the liturgy of what he can get away with, trying to make the liturgy more reformed, barely following the Book of Common Prayer as he continues to reform whatever church he has put in to preach. He meets at this time Marjorie Bowes. Her father and her brother are very much opposed to them getting married, but it's at this point that they start courting, and there is an intent to get married, but her father is very much opposed to it at that time. He is assigned to St. Nicholas Church in 1550, where he serves as a pastor for several years. He is made also a royal chaplain in 1551 and actually gets to preach in front of Edward VI. As Thomas Cranmer is pushing for the new edition of the Book of Common Prayer in 1552, Knox starts really railing against the way in which communion is presented within the Book of Common Prayer. They're supposed to kneel. He's going, you're kneeling before the elements. That's idol worship. We shouldn't do that. So Cranmer inserts a statement to the effect that by kneeling, we are in no way reverencing the elements as anything other than bread or wine. Knox gets some corrections put into the Book of Common Prayer, but he doesn't agree with Cranmer. Cranmer is still doing things by halves. He doesn't feel like Cranmer is really putting enough effort into it. He's beholden too much to the aristocracy and to these other bishops and to the king, which really grates on Knox. It's going to constantly be a theme that he keeps coming back to. Ultimately, Cranmer decides that he needs to make Knox a bishop. He needs to make him Bishop of Rochester. Recently, the recently vacated bishopric of Rochester, remember Nicholas Ridley had originally been the Bishop of Rochester. As he becomes Bishop of London, the bishopric of Rochester becomes open, and they want Knox to just kind of slide in there and take that position. Knox declines. He looks at it. He considers it. He's really not interested in Episcopalian forms of church government. He's not interested in the Book of Common Prayer. He's really feeling like this is not the place for him. So he rejects the position of Bishop of Rochester, but there are a lot of politicians throughout England who think Knox is very useful. He's a very fiery preacher. He can really get people moving. He really knows his stuff. He's dedicated to the Reformation. So we really need him in a position within the church. And so they push for him to become the Vicar of All Hallows, under Nicholas Ridley in London. And so he goes to the church, he preaches a sermon, and decides, you know what, I can't do this. He tells Nicholas Ridley, says, I really can't be involved with this. I'm going to go to the continent. I'm going to go to Geneva. So they let him go. And he goes to Geneva, he meets with John Calvin. Now, what's interesting, I mean, when you think of reformers and you think of the Reformed, you think John Calvin is a very reformed guy. John Knox, his meeting with John Calvin, he wants to meet the great reformer in Geneva. They've just had the trial of Michael Servetus. Calvin's kind of a celebrity at this point for being the defender of the faith. So Knox wants to meet John Calvin, and so he goes to his house on the Lord's Day and finds the man lawn bowling with his family and is completely appalled. You might remember if you've done the Westminster Confession of Faith, on the Sabbath day, there's a prohibition against all worldly works and recreations, and so Knox definitely held that recreations like lawn bowling should not be done on a Sunday, on the Lord's Day. And so so at this point we find Knox is more reformed in some ways than Calvin. At least, so we see that division between the continental position on the Sabbath as opposed to the English position on the Sabbath as Knox goes to Geneva. He meets with Calvin. He starts to really question Calvin on the subject of to what degree are we to be beholden to monarchs? Okay, because he's just spent 5 years with Cranmer. He doesn't like the way Cranmer bows and scrapes to monarchs. So to what degree are we to submit to governing authorities? And so he asks Calvin four questions to that effect. Calvin deftly dodges most of them and refuses to give firm answers to him. And, I mean, Calvin's not exactly in a very stable position there in Geneva either at this point. His position is stabilizing, but he's not very stable. So he's very reluctant to make a hard stance on how beholden you're supposed to be to governing authorities. So he says, why don't you go talk to Heinrich Bullinger? Bullinger will have the answers for you. So he writes letters to Bullinger. Bullinger also dodges the question, so he decides, you know what, I've got to go find the answers myself. So he says, thank you for your time. And he goes to Frankfurt, where there is a church of English refugees who need a pastor. He spends 2 years in Frankfurt as a pastor of an English-speaking church, English refugees fleeing from the... This is an important note. He leaves in 1554, just before Edward VI dies. So as Knox is leaving, Mary Tudor takes the throne. And so then Cranmer and Ridley and Latimer are executed. So as he's going to Frankfurt, that's what's happening in England. There are a lot of English refugees who have come to Frankfurt to get away from the persecutions and the executions going on in England. And so he is their pastor. But as he gets there, he realizes there is a very strong traditionalist faction here in this group. They want him to go strictly by the Book of Common Prayer. He's not allowed to deviate from it. He's not allowed to do his own liturgy. He's not allowed to make reformed amendments to it. He has to go as written to the Book of Common Prayer. He bristles under this for about a year and a half, and finally decides, you know what, I can't do Anglicanism. I cannot deal with bishops and with books of common prayer. We have to use Scripture and Scripture only. Says, I got to be done with this. So he leaves Frankfurt, and at that time he also receives a letter from Marjorie Bowes, or actually from her sister, saying, please come back to Scotland, and you need to come back quickly. So he goes to Scotland. He marries Mary Bowes at that time. She wants to marry him, even though he's a wanted man running from the law. But in returning, Mary of Guise doesn't hunt him down. She doesn't have him arrested. He's allowed to continue preaching. He is brought up on trial and supported by the lords of Scotland and allowed to preach openly in Scotland at this point. And as he's doing this, as he's starting to preach in Scotland, he suddenly gets a letter from Geneva saying, hey, we've got English-speaking refugees here in Geneva. We would like you to come and be a pastor here in Geneva. And so he goes, okay, I've received a call. I have to go. I have a pulpit that needs to be filled, so I'm going to go to Geneva. I feel like this is where I have to be. So he packs up his wife and his mother-in-law, and he moves to Geneva. And he spends 4 years in Geneva. Now, in Geneva, he is starting to work around how the church ought to be governed. He knows he doesn't like the bishops. He knows he doesn't like Anglicanism as it exists. And he's looking at what Calvin's doing in Geneva and going, we can work with this. We can use this form of government, this type of government in a church. And so he starts developing a Presbyterian polity at this point. The election of elders and deacons, and those are the only two offices in the church. Calvin actually had four offices in the church, but there were pastors, doctors, elders, and deacons. There were no bishops. And so it was that concept of, with Presbyterian government, we have the elder functions as you can have pastors, elders, and the role of pastor, elder, and doctor can all be filled by one office, and then you've got the deacon for the other. So you've got this Presbyterian government, the idea that the elections happen from the laity, from the people, from the congregation, and not handed down from kings or bishops, that you don't have pastors being delegated to a congregation. The congregation is supposed to elect and call their own pastor. So as he's in Geneva, he gets time to sit down and write, and he writes probably his most, we could call it famous, but infamous might be a better term. His most famous work, The First Trumpet Blast Against the Monstrous Regime of Women. So John Knox looks around Europe and he decides, you know what's wrong with Europe today? We've got all of these queens killing all of the saints, and so the queens are what the problem is, and there's this, comparing them to Athaliah in the Book of Kings, it's like Josiah's grandmother, you know, just, this is an aberration, this is an abomination against God and the natural order of things, and so he writes that that's what's wrong with Europe today. Now, his timing in 1558 is probably the worst it could have been, because as it's getting published, Mary Tudor dies and Elizabeth Tudor becomes Queen of England. And as this book is published and Elizabeth Tudor rises to the throne of England, she is not amused. She doesn't like what he has said about her in this. Elizabeth, as she takes the throne, she had been baptized by Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer had been her godfather, so as she takes the throne, she starts re-implementing all of Thomas Cranmer's reforms in England, and she really doesn't like John Knox. And so she makes that very known a couple of years later as he's trying to get back to Scotland. She says, fine, you can go back to Scotland, just not through England. So Knox is not allowed back in England from this point on because Elizabeth holds a grudge. But he was his position that the problem with Europe was that it was ruled by queens wasn't unique to him. This was actually a very common position. He was just one that was saying it in a very belligerent way. Also, the Geneva Bible was completed during his time in Geneva, and he brought that back to Scotland with him as well. He contributed to some of the study notes in that. But as he's writing, as he's preaching in Geneva, he starts to develop his Presbyterian polity. He starts to develop his positions on many of the Reformed teachings. We'll get into his distinctives as we go. As we get to the end, we'll swing back around and cover his theological positions. But after 4 years in Geneva, he decides that, you know, he needs to go back to Scotland. Now that Elizabeth is on the throne, now that there are no more persecutions, all the English-speaking peoples are moving back to England, and the church which he had been pastor of is dissolving, so it's time to go back. So in 1560, he heads back to Scotland. And of course, Elizabeth will not let him go back through England, so it takes him about 9 months to get to sail around England and up to Scotland and find a ship that's willing to do that in good weather in which they can sail. So he makes it to Scotland in 1560, where he is welcomed back and is now kind of the leader of the church in Scotland, having spent this much time with John Calvin and having new ideas on how to organize the church. They start doing a lot of Presbyterian, the Presbyterian polity starts taking over in Scotland, becomes very, very popular in Scotland. They write the Scots Confession in 1560, which is the foundational document for that church. It was a Reformed document. It was a very good document, but it was a bit rustic. Knox wasn't the most eloquent speaker, but he's a very passionate speaker, and he is a very direct speaker. So when he writes the Scots Confession, it's a very good document, but it is ultimately replaced in 1647 with the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the same document we use, because it's a much broader, much bigger document that is much more eloquently worded. In 1561, they developed the Book of Discipline for how churches were going to be run, how elections for officers would be held, how pastors would be elected, how disputes in churches and church discipline was going to be held, be governed. And so they start really laying the groundwork for the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. Now, at this point, there are still bishops. There are still Roman Catholic factions throughout Scotland, but the Presbyterian government is starting to really take hold among the people. It's only the aristocracy that tend to hold to bishops at this point. You do see it's not so much an Anglican church. There is now a distinctly Church of Scotland as opposed to a Roman Catholic church in Scotland. But there are still bishops, so that's an important thing, that they don't get rid of bishops until 1689. And a lot of the reason for that is because of the monarchy. We're going to get into monarchy a little bit here. So Mary, the Queen of Scots, Mary Stuart, not Mary Tudor, Mary Stuart, the daughter of James V, is now at the age of majority. She's now old enough to rule for herself without a regent. She comes back to Scotland. She finds the Reformation is in full swing, that Scotland is now a Reformed country, and she tells everybody, she's very charming, she's very cunning, and she tells everybody, I'm not going to overthrow the church. I'm not going to stop your worshiping in the way you want to worship. Just allow me to hold a private mass at my own little palace at Holyrood Palace in the Holyrood Chapel. Just one mass, that's all you need to give me. Knox was firmly against it. He spoke against it very vehemently. He was very strongly opposed to allowing even one mass to be held in Scotland. But the aristocrats were willing to give her this just so that they could get in her good graces and that things would work well with their queen. Yeah. So the so she is allowed to hold mass in her chapel. Now, she also tends to skirt around the law a little bit on that. She's allowed one mass in her chapel. Well, then she starts traveling around the country setting up little chapels here and there, and even if they're still holding mass after she leaves and isn't coming back, you know, there's it's technically still her chapel, and she's allowed to have mass in her private. She finds ways around the law. She finds loopholes. So anyway, in this, John Knox is her biggest detractor in Scotland, and so she is. She decides that she's going to try to pacify John Knox. She's going to do this through charm and through wit, and these are not weapons that work on John Knox. He's a man that seems to be immune to these things. As he walks into her palace, he is met by her four ladies-in-waiting, all of them named Mary, all dressed to the nines. They're just decked out in the latest fashions of France. And John Knox looks at that and says, that is vanity. And he, I mean, you're off to a great start now. He's already starting to preach. So Knox is not impressed with Mary. She invites him to sit down to civil discourse, to where we can talk about these things. And so she starts talking to him about his position on civil disobedience and power of monarchs. You're preaching against me. You're saying that I'm an evil person. You've written a book about how queens are the very problem with Europe today, that queens are an unnatural form of government. So are you not preaching sedition? And so Knox tells her, says, well, no, we are commanded through Scripture that we are supposed to submit ourselves to the governing authorities. Paul wrote this while Nero was emperor of Rome, so I can abide you as well. If he can abide Nero, I can abide you. And so you've got this idea that he's able to answer her in ways that are, he's able to match her wit and also insult her at the same time. So he compares her to Nero. He compares her, he calls her, he continues to maintain that she is wicked, but he can still submit to her as long as she is using lawful authority. And he starts making this distinction between lawful authority and unlawful orders. So as long as she is acting lawfully according to the authority given to her by God, according to Scripture, he will obey. The moment she steps across that line and starts ordering things that God has not commanded, or not given her authority for, he's free to disobey and free to encourage others to disobey. And so she's unable to pin him down on anything that should be considered treason. It's all theological. And she tries to argue against him theologically, but is unable to convince him to her side. That was the first interview in 1561. In 1562, while she's going around doing this spreading of masses around the Scottish countryside, he starts preaching publicly against her. And against her actions in Scotland. And so she calls him in for another interview, saying, okay, if you've got a problem with me, just come to me personally and say it. You don't have to say it to all of Scotland. You can say it to me. We just keep this between us. To which he tells her, says, no, I can't do that because what you are doing is affecting the entire nation, and I am supposed to minister to the entire nation, and where you are affecting the whole nation, I must speak to the whole nation. And so she's unable to get him to be quiet about it on that point either. So in 1563, she tries again. A group of priests had held an unlawful mass without her knowledge in Ayrshire, and John Knox, and they were immediately arrested. And so she calls John Knox in to kind of pacify the situation. She takes him off guard when she says that she fully agrees with the arresting of the priests, that what they did was wrong, and that shocks him that she's willing to at least say that much. But once again, they're unable to come to an agreement on exactly how Roman Catholicism is to be practiced by her. I mean, according to Knox, it shouldn't be practiced at all. So she's unable to gain ground with him on that point. Then she wants to marry the Spanish Don Carlo to form an alliance with Spain. John Knox is very strongly opposed to this and encouraging the Lairds of Scotland to also be opposed to this marriage. And so she calls him in and asks, why does who I marry affect you? And says, well, because I'm a Scotsman and because you're the queen and you're bringing in foreign influences to Scotland and we can't have this. So she gets very angry about him and ultimately in the final interview accuses him outright of treason. Takes him in front of the Lords of Scotland, in front of the Privy Council, where he is acquitted and found not guilty of treason. So there is back and forth between Knox and the Queen Mary of Scotland, and it's a very difficult situation. She is trying to reassert her power and regain power in Scotland and finding that it is more and more being given to the commoner, that there is a more democratic system. The more the Presbyterians take over, it becomes more democratic. So this was a problem for her. She can't resolve it. This is also one of the reasons why People refer to Knox as a misogynist is because of his treatment of Mary, Queen of Scots, in addition to his writing of the first trumpet blast against the monstrous regime of women. Those tend to get him labeled as a misogynist. But looking at the rest of his life, that is clearly not his position. He is not a misogynist. It's just in these two instances that taking them out of context and blowing them out of proportion, we can make that claim. So in 1560, his wife, Marjorie Bowes, had passed away. They had had two children together. I can't remember if either of those actually survived to adulthood. But in 1564, he shocks everybody and kind of creates a miniature scandal when he marries Margaret Stuart. He is 50 years old. She is 17. She is also a cousin to the queen. So there's... But together, they're married for 8 years. They have three children, Martha, Margaret, and Elizabeth. And so Knox is, at this point, starting to decline in his popularity throughout Scotland, but his ideas don't. Presbyterian polity is taking hold all over Scotland. Reformed theology is present everywhere in Scotland. And so Knox's ideas are spreading like wildfire over the entire country, while Knox himself kind of fades into obscurity at this point. Historically, he just kind of drops out of the limelight while his ideas continue to spread. Meanwhile, Queen Mary, she marries Henry Stuart, another distant cousin of hers, Lord Darnley, as he is also known, in 1565. In 1566, through a conspiracy, Lord Darnley has David Rizzio murdered. There are several conspirators that he has do the dirty work for him, but David Rizzio is killed. David Rizzio is the Italian secretary to Queen Mary. Queen Mary retaliates by having Lord Darnley murdered. So that implies something, I think. So anyway, Mary was then forced to abdicate the throne, and her infant son, James, was made King James VI of Scotland. While all of this is going on in 1566, Knox writes probably his biggest work, his magnum opus, The History of the Reformation in Scotland. Once again, like I said, he writes everything in the third person, so he kind of downplays his own role in the Reformation. He is allowed to preach the sermon at the coronation of James VI on July the 29th in 1567. It's important to note that while Mary is in prison, there is a civil war going on, and James VI is in the custody of the Presbyterians, and they are seeing to his education, making sure he is properly educated. And so the Scottish Civil War from 1568 to 1573, as the two sides, the Presbyterians on one side with the those supporting Mary on the other, England gets involved on the Scottish side. Mary is able to get French support, and so there is a long war. Knox dies near the end of it in 1572. But it's important to note that the death of Knox goes unnoted. Nobody in all of Scotland, no high-ranking official of any kind, took any note of the date that he died. He dies quietly at home with his wife, reading from 2 Corinthians. He has been sick for most of his life. He has been a weak man, a small man for his entire life. Mostly his sickness comes from his 19 months on the galleys. He never fully recovered physically from that. He remained weak and sick throughout his entire career, which is important because, as he points out, it says he's a weak man. He is not a powerful man. He didn't bring Reformation to Scotland. God did that. And so Knox is the first to say that God is the one doing the work, that any work that is attributed to Knox is actually the work of God because Knox is too weak to have actually done this. And that's Knox's own opinion on this. So he dies then in 1572, but the Reformation continues. And of course, I mentioned the monarchs of Scotland. James VI goes on to become James I of England after the death of Queen Elizabeth. James I of England doesn't like Presbyterians, having been raised by them his entire life and deciding they just don't show proper respect for kings. that bishops show more respect for kings and presbyters do not. So he keeps bishops in place in Scotland throughout his reign, and also through the reign of Charles I and Charles II. So it's a while before they get a Scottish king that's willing to go full Presbyterian. But in these early kings, they like having bishops around, while the church itself is predominantly Presbyterian. So that's the history of the man. So before we get into his theological distinctives, is there anything we need to clarify? Any questions? Thoughts? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, he is a man of prayer. He's a man of faith, and it's important because he's not physically imposing at all. And it's like he is bringing terror to Queens, not because of who he is physically, but because of who he is and what he represents spiritually. So, yes.
At the risk of stealing some of your thunder. Oh. John Owen's influence on Cromwell, Cromwell's influence on the Magna Carta, and the Magna Carta's influence on the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah.
And we would not have our Constitution without Calvin and Knox.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, the Presbyterian, yeah, the whole history of Presbyterianism and how it ties into democracy and the forming of constitutions, That is beyond the scope of this class, but that is well worth noting, that Presbyterians as a church have been very heavily involved in the forming of democracies globally. And so it's very, very important to study that. But we're in the Reformation. History of Presbyterianism is a whole other can of worms. We do not have time for today. But yeah. Well, but that is the position, is that God has ordained his church and has set some to be pastors over his church.
Yeah.
And so where do we get our pastors from? And so, from people. But the idea was, at the time, for 15 centuries, what they had been doing was, a king got to decide who was your pastor.
Yeah.
And it was a guy who said what the king wanted him to say, not what God wanted him to say. And that's what John Knox is doing here, is he's going, we don't want pastors who are going to be the king's guy. We want pastors that will say what God said to say.
Yeah, which is the right way.
Right. And that's why we look back to Knox and go, this is where we come from. This is, yes. Vicar, so a vicar is, it's kind of a parish priest of sorts. I think it's a parish priest of some sort. I'm not certain what the full distinction is, but it's below a bishop, and it's dealing with a certain parish within a certain bishopric. But it is a form of a priest. Just another side note there, the word priest is a contraction of the word presbyter. So when we say we have presbyters, we're Presbyterian, that word gets shortened down to priest, and that's where we get the word priest from. So it's that office of the pastor of a church and a vicar. Vicar is an English term, actually. You see it a lot more in Anglicanism than you do in any other. Well, but even the Pope is referred to as the Vicar of Christ. So it's a way that, living life vicariously, that they are representative of something. So being the vicar there, the representative of this parish.
The representative of
right. So a vicar is kind of but they are a representative of a parish. So a vicar is, a parish is a geographical location. So in a parish system, if you live in a certain geographical location, you belong to a specific church who is in charge of your oversight. Right. But we actually don't have a parish system anymore. We used to back before the Great Awakening, but the Great Awakening destroyed the parish system in America. But that's a whole other story for a whole different time. A vicar is a type of priest over top of a geographical location within a certain parish. And I realize I'm using terms and forgetting to define my terms so that everybody who doesn't know what those terms mean still has no clue what I mean. So any other thoughts? Anything I need to clarify? This is why I ask for questions. What do I need to clarify? Yes. Yep. So he served his time in the French galleys. He went to the Church of England, which was Reformed and was looking for good Reformed preachers. Knox was already ordained in the Church of Scotland. He already had a history as a preacher. He had a very fiery style of preaching that really could hold your attention. It's important to note he had a fiery style of preaching, and he preached on average 2 hours. Whenever he would preach a sermon, he preached for 2 hours, and he would preach 3 sermons a week. So that's, yeah.
Did John Knox ever lighten up on his position on women and secular authority? I know John Calvin pushed him on that to some degree, right?
With Queen Elizabeth, he was kind of forced to just go, I wrote what I wrote, and we're going to leave it at that. He definitely recognized he had said something at the wrong time with Queen Elizabeth coming to the throne and being supportive of the Reformation in England, at least to the degree that she was. Because even she didn't go as fully into the Reformation as Knox would have liked. I don't know that he ever walked back on that position entirely. We are going to get into a little bit of his reforms in Scotland, and one of the things that we do get is his focus on humility. So John Knox very strongly opposed anybody who had a position of power. If they had a position of power, he felt like he had a position. He had an obligation biblically to speak truth to power. It's like I have to stand up to you. It's like he's this timid, weak, sickly Scotsman who, the moment that he's faced with a monarch who is telling him, you can't say that, he is immediately in their face going, yes, I can, because God told me I can. And so you have this thing of, when it comes to queens and kings and dukes and earls and other types of lords that are telling him, you can't do this, he believes that that is pride and it needs to be opposed. But he himself lives very strongly convicted about humility. He is a very humble man himself, but he doesn't speak about himself. But the moment he is faced with power that is corrupt, he immediately steps up and becomes the champion of the faith on that front. And so he's kind of a contradiction, but he's very much on the focus of humility. But at the same time, you have to speak truth no matter what and no matter to who.
And since he's a good man to have on your
corner. Well, he is, yeah. As long as
what you're doing is upright.
Yeah, as long as you were being biblical, he was definitely defending the biblical faith. His time with Cranmer gave him a hatred of pragmatism. There's really no other way to say that. So pragmatism is, we have to do this because it's the smart way to do it. It's the practical thing to do. So Cranmer is going, well, we can't really fully reform the church because we have a king who doesn't really want to reform the church. So let's just go as far as the king will let us, and we're not going to really fight about it. Knox had seen how that worked for Cranmer. He did not like it, and so he started pushing back, saying, no, kings have this much authority, and that's it. This is the authority of the monarchy. This is what God has given to the monarchy. As long as they're within the boundaries of that authority, absolutely obey them. But when they step out of that, you are obligated to disobey. And so he starts rejecting any position which is taken for purely pragmatic reasons. And so his position on the regulatory principle of worship is very, very strict. He takes the position that unless God has actually commanded it in Scripture, we are not allowed to worship him any way other than what he has commanded.
Amen.
Well, but that, in Knox's view, meant no musical instruments, you sing psalms only, no ornamentation of any kind. It's just very, very strict in how we were going to worship.
Yeah, but you're supposed to sing to Jesus.
Yeah, well, and he agreed. So they sing psalms without musical accompaniment. So yeah, it was a very strict church. Knox held some very strict positions. Well, actually, there are still Covenanters and other churches, Presbyterian churches today, that still hold to this. This is still a minority, but it still exists within Presbyterianism today. He also, full 20% of his sermons and writings are on the subject of predestination. It's important to note that predestination at this point wasn't the controversial issue it is today. He used it as an evangelistic tool. He used it as an argument for the assurance of salvation, and he focused very heavily on predestination. With his positions on the regulative principle of worship and his pursuit of Reformed theology also becomes the basis of English Puritanism in the years to come. And that ultimately leads to the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And another thing which I didn't put on the sheet, which is important, is that John Knox pushed for the first national education system in Europe, in Scotland. He insisted that every child in Scotland be taught to read and to write, and that the government was going to pay for it, and that that was going to be done, boys and girls alike. Everybody had to come and learn to read, and the curriculum is the Geneva Bible and the Scots Confession. And we're going to teach them theology, and we're going to teach them to read and write. And that was the first public education system, and it was equal opportunity to everybody in Scotland. And so that was the way the Reformation also spread, was through that reform of the education system in Scotland. It also made Scotland a much more educated nation than the rest of Europe, because they had a much more educated populace than the rest of Europe at that point. And so then you get the Scottish Enlightenment and a whole bunch of philosophical movements that come out of that. So there's a lot of things that come out of Presbyterianism that we could look at. This is a whole other complicated issue. So any other thoughts, anything we need to clarify? Next week will be the final lesson in this series. We are going to go to Holland for the final part, and we're going to talk about the Synod of Dort. And for those of you who might have been wondering why we didn't talk about the 5 points of Calvinism with Calvin, it's because they don't become 5 points until the Synod of Dort. And so we're going to be talking about that next week. So, thank you.